This is De Atlantische Blik, a podcast from the Netherlands Atlantic Association. My name is Jonathan Gruber, and this episode is a little special. First of all, the Netherlands Atlantic Association has moved. The offices are now located in Het Nutshuis in the center of The Hague. And to mark this occasion, and to commemorate the 75th anniversary of NATO, we hosted an event on the 2nd of April. Our guest was Oana Lungescu. Ms. Lungescu is the former advisor and spokesperson to the NATO Secretary General. She was interviewed by Duarte Kuipers, a journalist for Follow the Money. And while we celebrated the past, Duarte and Oana's conversation was fixed firmly on NATO's future.
Thank you all for joining us. It's good to see like the entire audience well filled. Next to me we have someone also known as Lorena to the communist secret police, the Securitate, in 1983, because you were refusing to cooperate with them. They had actually a tracking file on you with the code name Lorena. And what I found really interesting when I looked at your personal life and your career, there's this sort of like overlap to the institutional growth of NATO. So I was wondering, just as a starter, like, what were the most fundamental changes from your perspective, first starting out as a journalist, later as a spokesperson to NATO, when it comes to not only strategic narratives, but also strategic actions?
Okay, there's about four questions in that. But,
we'll narrow them
I'll
down
see
on
what
the way.
I can do. Yeah. But you're right that I discovered when I did a couple of documentaries for the BBC, looking back into the Securitate, the secret police archives, that I had a couple of files from when I was in Romania, and after that, after I started working for the BBC World Service, because of course the secret police was following everybody who was working for foreign radio stations, which was seen as the enemy. And also, of course, NATO was seen as the enemy. So as a young girl growing up in Romania, I remember listening to the BBC, Deutsche Welle, Radio Free Europe, literally under the bed covers, because I was afraid that my neighbors would hear the sound of the radio and report me to the Securitate. I then had to deal with them later, but I think this shows the fact that I became something I could never have imagined. You know, a journalist for the BBC first, and then spokesperson for NATO. Wow. I mean, not in my wildest dreams, in darkest communist Romania, would I have expected that. And it just shows how much Europe has changed. And I think the tremendous role that both NATO and the European Union have played in making that transformation in Europe and across the world. In terms of how much NATO has changed, I can give you one example which I think is quite telling. So I started their spokesperson in 2010 with the Lisbon summit, where NATO agreed to its previous strategic concept. And my last but one summit was in Madrid in 2022, when NATO agreed on its latest strategic concept, which I do have here. And if you haven't seen it, you know, it's worth reading. It's not too long, but yeah, this is what it looks like. And you have it online as well, of course. And it's really fascinating to read the two documents, because back in 2010, Russia was a strategic partner. NATO was aspiring to a strategic partnership with Russia. And at the Lisbon summit, and of course, Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer will remember all the NATO-Russia councils that you chaired. In Lisbon, we had then President Medvedev, who was attending the summit. And I remember negotiating with his team the fact that, you know, no, President Medvedev could not brief before the Secretary General and President Obama at the end of the summit. You know, there were some rules in NATO that even Russia had to obey. In that strategic concept, there was no mention of China. There was hardly any mention of climate change, just to give three examples. In the latest, the new strategic concept, of course, Russia is seen as the most immediate and direct threat to NATO, China, even though is not an enemy, is also seen as a challenge to our interests, security, and values. And of course, climate change is seen as the existential threat that it is. So a lot has changed. The world has changed, and NATO has changed with it. And that, I think, is the ultimate strength of NATO, that it brings Europe and North America together. We stand united, but we also change when the world changes.
Yes, yes. And I was wondering, because, well, you said, of course, there's a big difference between the strategic concept of 2010 and the one from 2022, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. What I was wondering, actually, two things. First of all, I remember when I sort of started out as a researcher in the area of defense, there was this saying going on, the new member states are looking for the old NATO, and the old member states are looking for a new NATO. It was in the time of the out-of-area operations. Yeah. Russia wasn't anymore a threat, etc. And I was remembering, like, around 2010, that saying was still sort of, like, going around. And I was wondering, like, has this sort of, like, divide, like, in strategic perceptions between old member states and new member states, has that been bridged? And has that been done in 2014, according to you, or 2022?
I think it's obviously each ally, and there are now 32 allies, will have its own history, its own geography, and its own perception of threats. So what things like the strategic concept do is to bring that threat perception and that assessment of the world we live in much closer together, so that all allies agree, yeah, this is a dangerous world, for instance, that is, you know, summing up the 2022 strategic concept. So, yeah, clearly there is an evolution. In 2014, I think there was a shock and a surprise when we saw Russia illegally annexing Crimea. In 2022, when Russia started its full-fledged invasion of Ukraine, it was a shock, but it was not a surprise. I think allies had a very clear-eyed view of what was happening, and actually, in the autumn of 21, we deliberately declassified an unprecedented amount of intelligence, of NATO intelligence, to warn our audiences, our publics, about what Russia intended, the type of capabilities and the range and amount of capabilities it was bringing to bear on the border with Ukraine, but also to create unity among our politicians and our leaders. And I think we saw that unity in the support that all NATO allies continue to provide to Ukraine. So I think it's important, not just in theoretical terms, that we have the same threat perception and the same understanding of what we have to do about it as an alliance. It's important also in real terms about how we can proceed further.
Yeah, and one thing is, of course, like the threat perception, and that's also sometimes based on interest countries have and their view and perspective on the world. But also when talking from a Dutch perspective, there is this thing that we have Professor Isabel Duivestein at the University of Leiden, what she calls sort of like strategic illiteracy, which is basically the tendency of the Netherlands, and I'm not sure whether it's a small country thing, to be very reactive, very ad hoc. For instance, when 2014 happened in Crimea, actually, all the intelligence was focused on Afghanistan, and they had to, call people back from their pension because everyone, you know, was gone. So there was no longer sort of like an institutional memory about Ukraine and Russia, etc. Is that something too that you see happening sometimes more often in NATO? Because I can understand within an alliance, there is also not only the perception of the threat, but also the responsiveness to strategic things happening. I mean, it was only until 2022 there's a mention of China in the strategic concept.
Yeah, I wouldn't criticize the Netherlands in particular, frankly.
I will do that for you. No, it's my job.
Because I think, as I said, in 2014, we were still aiming for a strategic partnership with Russia. And I remember very clearly, as NATO spokesperson, in the days, literally in the days before the illegal annexation of Crimea, we were actively working in the NATO-Russia Council on our first joint military mission with Russia, which would have been a naval mission to escort the Cape Ray, which was the US ship destroying weapons of mass destruction from Syria. I mean, had a joint mission, and obviously we're also cooperating on Afghanistan, among others. We are cooperating on countering terrorist attacks on mass transportation. So there was a lot going on, and I think that's why people were so shocked that Russia chose to throw away that partnership that we had all invested so much in. But the reality now, I think, is that we have moved much further together, and I think there is a much more collective understanding of the threat. In terms also of the fact that, for instance, if you look at the NATO's defense plans, the latest defense plans, which were agreed at last year's Vilnius summit, they focus on two threats: Russia and terrorism. So it's not one or the other, because we know we don't have the luxury to choose the threats. The threats are out there, and the threats are interrelated. There is no such thing as regional security. We can't just talk about the security of Europe in isolation. And that's not how Russia and China view things. If you look at the no limits partnership that Russia and China signed just on the eve of Russia's full-fledged invasion of Ukraine, on the margins of the Olympic Games in Beijing, China stated for the first time formally that it opposed the enlargement of NATO. So China clearly sees the world not as isolated theatres, but as a joint theatre, and we should do the same. Everything is interconnected. You know, if you look at the role that Russia is playing in Africa, if you look at the impact of the Middle East war on perceptions of elections in the United States, everything is interconnected. And if we fail to see and connect the dots, we risk making ourselves vulnerable.
And is the seeing of this interconnected, you know, strategic field, is it something of the last few years, in your view? Is it something that has grown?
Yeah, I think it's come much more to the fore. You know, there's also an education, if you wish, a strategic education for all of us. I think, yeah, we just need to be realistic and not just see the world as we would wish it to be. It would be a much nicer place, but I think we're in a very dangerous world for a long time to come. And I think we just need to be prepared and ready and vigilant.
Yeah. And I was wondering, because NATO is, of course, an intergovernmental organization. We had in Europe, you know, some leaders who were quite some time had the same position. We had Angela Merkel, who had been years over there, Macron years. Now, our own Prime Minister Rutte also been at the table and perceived to be the next Secretary General. What is the role of the stability amongst the leaders? Because I can understand that there is some sort of socialization going on in an intergovernmental organization. So does this also help to create this sort of common perspective also when it comes to the interconnectedness where you alluded to?
Yeah, and I think, you know, as a journalist and then working for NATO, I think there's one thing that really strikes me is how important personal relations are and personality. You know, it's a fact. And if people can get on together, if there's chemistry among leaders, it's much... And if they listen to one another, it's much easier to come to a solution. And of course, in NATO, what's really important is to get to consensus, right? This is what the job of the Secretary General is. And unless and until there is consensus, we can't move forward. But we also know that once we get consensus, we're much stronger moving forward, because everybody agrees on what is to be done.
Yeah. And what I found interesting, because you started out as a journalist, and that's basically from the outside looking in, and then you became a spokesperson, so you're from the inside, you know, looking out. What did you learn from the change in this perspective as well?
Yeah, it's. I thought I knew a lot because I had been covering NATO and the EU since 1997, first in Brussels and then in Berlin. But then I realized the complexity of the organization from the inside, and you know sometimes I compare it to three-dimensional chess that you know you just have to keep in mind. Obviously, you're not just dealing with the media. You know, you think that that's your job, but actually it's not. That's not the only part of the job. It's also about coordinating with allies, with the capitals, and of course with the military, and often you know with the EU, other international organizations. So it's much more complex. You realize, again, how much things are connected. But of course, I was very privileged and I'm very humble to have been part of what is, I think, the most troubled, the most complicated period in our history since the Cold War.
Yeah. And what would you describe as the most challenging period?
Look, I think 2021 was challenging because, of course, on the one hand, we were drawing down from Afghanistan, and you know, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from that mission. But on the other hand, we saw Russia's continued build-up on the border with Ukraine. So you could see both things happening in parallel. So obviously, Afghanistan was emotionally, logistically, in many different ways, it was very, very challenging. But we also had to focus on the other threat close to home.
Yeah, and as a speechwriter, I would say you were almost like a co-author of the strategic narrative of NATO. And I was wondering, we were talking about challenging times. I'm wondering very, very much what is like the hardest part to navigate. Like if we look at NATO as some sort of like a Rubik cube with all different layers and all interconnecting levels. Because, of course, first of all, you have, you know, the internal affairs, not only in terms of different perceptions of member states, maybe, but also, I would say, military, civil cooperation, binding that all together, but also externally, outside, especially when it comes to strategic narratives. We have a lot of, you know, like fake news has become a frequently used word. This disinformation campaigns, actually now in the Netherlands, we have the issue of political parties using, I wouldn't call it a Venn diagram because it's a perfect circle of using Kremlin narratives in our parliament. So these are also like external strategic narratives. So I was wondering what did you find the most difficult to navigate? Is it like the internal or is it more the extra strategic narratives from the outside that you have to counter?
Mm. Yeah, I think my approach has always been to be as proactive as we can, because I think there is, as you suggested also, you know, there's always a risk that we're behind the curve. And with disinformation, of course, disinformation has been with NATO and with us, you know, from the start of the alliance. And, you know, the Soviet Union used active measures, which have, of course, continued to influence the way they do business today. So back in 2014, for instance, after the illegal annexation of Crimea, I think NATO was the first international organization to set up a portal debunking Russia's key narratives about NATO, and we called it Setting the Record Straight, and it's still on the NATO website and gets updated. But as we moved towards 21 and the preparations for the full-fledged invasion of Ukraine, I think we deliberately decided to sort of pre-bunk, to prepare our audiences.
So you're not coming from a defensive position.
Exactly. So okay, come to it from an offensive position, if you wish, just to be as transparent as we could be, and providing a lot of intelligence, which until then had been classified, to make the case for what was going to happen. And I think that was unusual in a way. We took some risks at the time. also obviously some of our allies, the US in particular, but also the UK, were on the same approach. And as it happens, it's you know, pre-bunking is something that a Dutch academic, Sander van der Linden, has done some great work on. And I think it's the way to go. I think we cannot afford to just wait for this information to wash over our publics. We need to prepare them to build up resilience so that they recognize the patterns and the modus operandi when they see them, so they are more resilient and less likely to take the disinformation and make it their own, part of their own worldview.
And is this, I can now understand, because like we were talking earlier about, you know, different member states having different strategic visions on threat perceptions. So was it difficult to get, you know, everyone looking at the same, was everyone on the same page? Because some member states have some more ambiguity.
Yeah.
That's a tongue breaker.
Yeah.
Towards, for example, Russia. So I can understand that this...
Well, of course, you know, we can also use the prerogatives of the Secretary General, who is the principal spokesperson of the alliance, and who doesn't just need to forge consensus, but it's also there to lead the way. Mm-hmm. And so I think Jens Stoltenberg did that, and you know, I was happy to be able to support him. But of course, it's true. Looking back, it's not a secret that some of the allies, even after all the briefings, still could not imagine that exactly. Russia would actually invade Ukraine, and they thought this was a bluff. And you will all remember that, for instance, you know, the head of the military intelligence service of one of the allies happened to be in Kiev on the 24th of February, had to be extracted, took them 2 days to take him out of there. And the head of the intelligence service of another ally was sacked as a result. Because I think it's a failure of the imagination. Just like perhaps we could not imagine 9/11, it was still hard to imagine that something like this, a return to that sort of war in Europe, was even possible. It was not rational, people said. It was not reasonable. But of course, we need to understand that Russia and other authoritarian regimes have different ways of understanding the world.
Exactly. Would you say that this sort of, you can call it naivety, has been caused by not taking the strategic narrative of the counterpart too seriously, and maybe put Western standards on the way of reasoning? Like, for example, we were talking about earlier this interesting book coming out, The Age of the Strong Man, which basically sort of describes the development of more autocratic leaders, that in the beginning they're all in favor of democracy. They're all in favor of transparency, right? In the beginning, Erdogan started out too as a promise. In China, there was this same belief in, oh, they're, you know, embracing capitalism, so they might become a counterpart, like someone to cooperate with. We had the same stance actually towards Russia. You know, Moscow was very hip. It would become, you know, maybe even part and a strategic partner of NATO. So would you say that this is also a lack of imagination of the counterpart's logic, so to say, by applying our kind of logic? Like how we weigh losses and gains, for instance, could be different for other regimes than democracies, for instance.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the tolerance for risk, the threshold for risk, how you deal with human life,
for instance,
is very different, right? Mm. How many, you know, Russia, you know, there are 350,000 casualties, both killed and injured, among the Russian forces. I mean, can you imagine what that would mean in a Western democracy? You know, what would be the reaction? So I think, yes, there's a different calculus, but ultimately I think we just need to look at what regimes such as Russia do. We need to listen to what they say, because often what they say is actually a warning, and they will do as they say. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that in the past, but not always, because they will always try to obfuscate and confuse. A lot of this information is not about convincing, it's about confusing you about what is true and what is not true. But ultimately, we need to look at what they do. And that should guide us in terms of how we respond, because NATO, of course, is a defensive alliance. Mm-hmm. But to defend and to deter, you need to be strong and you need to be ready.
Yeah. It also, of course, goes to Western politicians and Western democracies, you know, talk the talk, walk the walk. But if you look, now's the time to become critical of the Netherlands.
Again.
If you look at the NATO reviews, for instance, like the yearly reports, and actually how the Netherlands are scoring on that, so to say, we don't really have a nice, you know, a scorecard. There are some things we're lacking behind. And if you compare those to the political choices in terms of investments and where these investments are being placed, it doesn't really look like the friends in The Hague are taking the NATO reviews very much to heart in terms of put your money where your mouth is. Is this something that's common with other countries that had, you know, a long period of austerity measures? Netherlands was not any different from other Western democracies. Do you see some discrepancy over there as well? Because there's a difference in, of course, giving Ukraine the weapons they need, but also making sure your own forces, armed forces, are NATO ready, so to say.
Mm. Let me first praise the Netherlands, because I think, you know, the Netherlands is a very strong supporter of of Ukraine. If you look at the Kiel Institute's Ukraine support tracker, I think you're number seven, perhaps even higher when it comes to military support. You look at the F-16 training and all the support that the Netherlands has been provided to Ukraine. I think that really has to be commended. Also, the security agreement over 10 years that Prime Minister Rutte signed in Kyiv recently. Also, in terms of contributions to NATO's battle groups, maritime forces, to air policing, I think the Netherlands done a great job. What we have seen over the last 10 years is that, of course, in terms of defense spending, there's been very significant progress. And since 2014, when at the Wales Summit leaders agreed on the defense investment pledge, including investing 2% of GDP in defense, I think there's been very, very significant progress. In 2023, last year, the increase among European allies was 11%, which is unprecedented in many, many decades. And, you know, that makes a big difference. Hopefully, we will have probably two-thirds of the 32 allies spending at least 2% of defense by the Washington summit. But I think we need to ask ourselves, is this enough? Is it fast enough? We're not really, you know, not all allies are sticking to the pledge made 10 years ago. We should be on 2% already and going beyond, as some countries like our Baltic allies and Poland are doing. Because we're doing that not just because we made the pledge, even though, you know, pacta sunt servanda, it's important that we keep our pledges. That is the basic element for the rules-based international order. But also, this is a more dangerous world in which we do need to keep our nation safe. So when it comes to cash, but also in terms of the capabilities that, for instance, NATO sets out through its tried and tested NATO defense planning process, asking each country to develop specific capabilities, because none of us can provide the full spectrum range of capabilities with the exception of the United States. So it's important that everybody does their bit. So from their point of view, I would hope that even before the Washington summit, we hear that the Netherlands, for instance, is investing 2%, as we've heard, for instance, from France, from Norway and others, so that there is a clear momentum towards 2% and beyond. And that is important, because I'm sure you're going to ask me, I think that's really important, whoever sits in the White House. Whether it's Joe Biden or whether it's Donald Trump, it does not matter. We're doing this not to please Biden or Trump or whoever is the US president, we're doing it for ourselves. And I think that is perhaps the main message that we all need to understand.
Yeah. And when we talk, actually now we're talking about cash and capabilities, but there's also another type of burden sharing, which is basically risk sharing. To what extent are you willing as a member state to use those capabilities for NATO goals? For instance, if you look at defense spending, Greece has a very nice 2% defense spending. But when it comes to commitment, burden sharing, providing troops, then you see that countries that were below the 2% threshold, financially speaking, were more sharing in their capabilities in the so-called risk or burden sharing. Is this something also that's in the back of the mind, institutionally speaking? Because I can understand with the common threats, it's very nice if you got everything in your Excel sheet on green, like we have the capabilities, we have the money going, but the preparedness and the willingness for countries to actually use those capabilities. Do you see a difference there between member states as well, or something that could, we've seen it of course in Afghanistan, but is it something that in the near future can be a risk?
Well, everybody has to contribute. That's yeah. for sure. That's the whole point of an alliance, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has to do the best they can. And I think, as I said, we have a clear framework, which is the NATO defense planning process. So it's not like we have to improvise. Oh, what do we need there? No. And we now have the most detailed, the most robust defense plans that the alliance has had since the Cold War. In a way, we're going back. It's, back to the future, if you will. But it's much more clear in terms of who and how we defend each part of the alliance, with what the capabilities, with what forces, who's in charge of doing what. And that's really important. And that's being exercised, actually, as we speak, in, again, the biggest exercise NATO has had since the Cold War, with 90,000 troops and very significant air and maritime capabilities. It's called Steadfast Defender. And it's, it started 2 months ago and it's still ongoing. So I think it's exercises like that that will show this is where we need to do more, this is where we don't have enough, and please, country XYZ, please make sure that you do fulfill those goals. And that may also apply to the Netherlands or Greece. It will apply to all allies.
Yeah, and when it comes to the biggest spender of the allies, of course, the United States, of course, we can have lots of fun describing how Donald Trump would present himself within NATO, but I think the question underlying that is how can NATO deal with the potential prospect of a US isolationism? Is actually the alliance prepared for that, especially with the interconnectedness of all everything that's going on in the Netherlands and the new strategic concept of 2022?
Look, I think that NATO's been a very good deal for all allies, including the United States. And I remember one of the highlights of my career was, as a spokesperson, was being in the U.S. Congress, where the joint houses of Congress, where Secretary General Stoltenberg made a speech in 2019, when we marked 70 years of the alliance. And that was the first. So it was the first time that the leader of NATO and the leader of an international organization was addressing the joint houses of Congress. Nothing like that had ever happened. And his main point to that bipartisan audience was, it's good to have friends. None of us, even a big country such as the United States cannot deal with the challenge of China on its own. If you have 31 allies and friends, no other superpower has that, and that will help keep you safe. So I think that's an important message, and I think that's also a reality that, you know, all political leaders in the United States understand, including Donald Trump. I think everybody also sees the polls in the United States, which continue to show unprecedented support for NATO and for the US's contribution to NATO. But I think if anybody in this room is worried about a potential Trump administration deciding to diminish its commitment to NATO, then the answer is to invest more in what unites us. The answer is to invest more in NATO to make sure that we do keep our pledges, that we do what we promised to do, and that we stay strong and united. Because, you know, if there's anything that our adversaries and our potential adversaries would like to see is the US and North America in general, the US and Canada and Europe going their own separate ways. Mm. So let's not give them that satisfaction. If we stand together, as we've done for 75 years, we can deal with any challenge.
Yeah. And I was wondering, because we talked about this a bit earlier, that sometimes, you know, if you're more than 5 to 10 years in the field, then you see some discussions re-emerging every other few years. One of them is the duplicating NATO by the EU. That's something that, again, the late 1990s, we saw that there's the fear of duplication of the common foreign and security policy. What we now see happening, it was already during the first administration of Donald Trump, of course, that European member states and also European member states of NATO were actually, well, in the face of potential, even potential American isolationism, we need to invest more and use, you know, pool the economical resources. So we have the EPF, for instance, within the European Union. I think it was like 2 weeks ago that the European Commission had a new strategic outlook, which was very ambitious. Is this something, again, that you, if you see this happening from, this is a repetitiveness of the late 90s, or is there something different going on here? Because, of course, since Brexit, we've seen the French, of course, also, you know, taking their strategic opportunity when it comes to defense spending and the potential contracts in Europe that can be fulfilled.
Mm. Yeah, I think that the relationship between NATO and the European Union has never been closer. I mean, I've been watching like this, like you, and like I think many of us in this room for many, many years, decades even. You know, it's for the first time, for instance, you know, we went in 2021. Jens Stoltenberg and Ursula von der Leyen went together to Lithuania to show unity in the face of the weaponization of migration by Belarus and Russia. And then we realized this is the first time that the NATO Secretary General and the President of the European Commission are traveling together, you know, to send a very clear signal of the unity of the West, of Western institutions. Again, on the 24th of February, you know, hours after Russia had invaded and NATO had activated its defense plans, at NATO headquarters, we had Ursula von der Leyen and Charles Michel again giving a message of unity to face Russia's aggression. So I think it's very important that we do stand together as organizations, you know, like-minded organizations of democratic countries, because that sends a very strong signal. So from that point of view, I think it's unprecedented cooperation. I think it's also important that the EU uses all the instruments that it has, and it certainly has more money than NATO, to sort of support Ukraine and to encourage and foster the defense production bases. Where I think we need to be careful about self-fulfilling prophecies is to say, well, maybe this will happen in the United States. We don't know, but this is what we think, based on, you know, what we think. That so then we should be going our own way. I think that would be a tragic mistake, because you know, if we were concerned about Donald Trump or anybody else saying America first, and then our response to that is Europe first, Europe alone, I think that would be the worst possible signal we can send. I think it's really important that we continue to work together. I think it's important that we continue to encourage not just the European, but also the transatlantic defense production base, and that we do more together rather than copy-pasting what somebody else does or trying to duplicate what they do. I think there is enough in the world to do and enough to do in Europe, but going it alone, I think, is not the answer. It's not the answer for America, and it's not the answer for Europe.
And what would you say would be the biggest challenge for the years to come? Would it be more on this type of commitment, being aware of self-fulfilling prophecies on the other hand? Would it be in terms of interoperability, you know, working together, training together as much as possible? Or would it actually to be, well, we talked about it, like putting your money, not only your money where your mouth is, but also in terms of risk and burden sharing?
I think we just need to up our game on everything.
On every level.
Yeah, because yeah. I think, unfortunately, and I may just be pessimistic by nature, but I just don't see a quick, easy way out of this very complex and dangerous dynamic that we're in, not for because of our own choice. So I think we need to realize the world we live in and to just, you know, just focus more. And it's hard because people lose patience. You know, we have a short span of attention, but others don't. Others think in long history cycles. I think we
they have
need
the time.
Yeah, we need to think less in election cycles and more in the long cycle of history. And you know, it's not easy, but I think this is the task ahead, to just be prepared for, you know, years of conflict, and to be prepared that if we allow Putin to win in Ukraine, his appetite might not stop there. And the appetite of other authoritarian regimes will also grow, because they realize that if you use force, you can achieve your goals.
Isn't that the price to pay to live in a democracy, that you always have to deal with, of course, member states, you know, not thinking ahead, having a sort of like a manager's reflex, like I'm here in office for 4 years, whatever happened, the 6 years, that's for the next guy to turn in. Because if we face like more authoritarian regimes, for instance, China, the use of TikTok even, where Chinese children get, you know, educational things to be seen, they cannot use TikTok after 9 o'clock. And the TikTok version that we get in Western country basically fries the brains of our children. I mean, that's also a way of strategic thinking with a long-term planning, where you don't immediately see the effects, but you put, you know, your effort into it. And isn't that something that there's the luxury, actually, of authoritarian regimes against, you know, the things we, you know, NATO actually tries to, the institutions that NATO is trying to defend are the democracies that actually inherently have this problem of short-sightedness sometimes. So how do you deal with this paradox is maybe the...
It's I don't pretend to have all the answers. I'm not on TikTok. I can tell you that, but I am on X, which of course is banned in China, even though the Chinese disinformation uses all possible platforms. So yeah, we need to be creative, and we need to be patient and have some more strategic patience, and just remind ourselves of the stakes. You know, this is about our way of life. Ultimately, it's about our freedom to live as we wish to do.
I think that's a very good conclusion for this part of the conversation, because I would like to actually open up the floor for any questions or any remarks from the audience. So please make use of the seizure moment now that you have it. we have a question over there.
Thank you. Is it on? Should I switch something? Mm-hmm.
It's on, yeah.
Thank you so much. My name is Bibi van Ginkel. I work for the International Center for Counterterrorism. I was wondering, just to take you a little bit on a journey, because even if we project into the future, thinking about the threats and how the alliance should stick together, we're still thinking about scenarios that are very much projecting a potential conflict on the European continent. But since China is also becoming more and more aggressive, there is also a scenario where China actually could attack the US, and then it would mean for European states to come to the rescue for the US. To what extent, how do you look at such a scenario? Is that completely far-fetched? Is that at all at the minds of people? How could that change also the narrative and the way of thinking within Europe?
Obviously, I'm no longer the spokesperson for NATO, so... but yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the sort of scenario that I was hinting at by saying that if we allow Putin to win in Ukraine, other things will be seen as possible and easier. And so, of course, you can imagine all sorts of scenarios, and scenario planning is part of the exercises that NATO conducts, not just related to peer-to-peer conflict, but also when it comes to terrorism. That's why I was saying that the defense plans that we have currently also take into account terrorism and take into account the nexus between various challenges. I agree that we need to have, you know, if we've learned a lesson, one lesson from Russia is the dependencies that Europe had on Russian energy, and I think that's a huge achievement by the European Union in particular to sort of wean Europe off Russian energy, perhaps faster than anyone thought was possible. And of course, the mild weather and climate change helped. But still, so these things are possible. So we also need to assess and be aware of our vulnerabilities as regards China in particular, and what that means for our interests, what it means, including, you know, for the green transition, how much we depend on Chinese rare earths and materials in order to achieve the green transition that we all want. So I think there's lots of interdependencies that we need to take into account, where, yes, some element of autonomy are necessary, and maybe there are things that we can do, things that we can't do, but when we do them, we need to be aware of their implications.
And as a follow-up question, I'm wondering, because I think one of the great challenges of these times is, when do you know you are aware of something? In the sense that there's so much flow of information.
It's the great Rumsfeldian questions.
We're not even talking about disinformation or propaganda or any of those, but just the streams of data, the streams of information that we can use. And we already saw it during COVID, that also within governments, there's not enough capabilities or capacity to deal with these type of numbers. There's also, I would say, apart from strategic illiteracy, also statistic illiteracy. And if you cannot deal with 200 data points, you cannot get a better answer with 200,000 data points. If any, you will get even more lost. So how would you know where to pinpoint and, you know, give the correct weight to all these variables, these potential scenarios? Is that something that will be more difficult?
Sure. I think, you know, we have people for that. and I think that's why exercising is so important. But I think the other thing that's really important is resilience, which is not just about, you know, a specific government, a specific time, but, you know, the whole of society resilience, which is why it's important to have media literacy, to have a better understanding of how disinformation works, and to be better prepared. You know, and it's some of the stuff that, for instance, the chairman of the military committee, Admiral Rob Bauer, has also been speaking about, you know, in terms that, we each of us need to be prepared. You know, don't just expect the prime minister or, you know, NATO secretary general to deal with this. This is something that will affect and does affect all of us in our day-to-day life.
Are there any other questions, Kenneth? Usama, yes, I recognize you.
Hi, thank you. So my name is Kenneth Ponisama. We of course speak of external threats. And you kind of said, well, of course we have to be united, and but there's this assumption that we are still a community of values. So when it comes to, for instance, the election of Donald Trump, it actually does matter, at least for me, whether that community of values still holds, because we also have authoritarian tendencies in the United States. We have also in countries in Europe. How do we deal with that? Is that a big concern, that the threat to NATO is not externally from but from within, in undermining that very basic assumption?
Yeah, I mean, that I think ties up with what I was talking about at the end now about resilience, because I agree. Our societies are democracies, so yeah, we're very different. We may have very different ideas. We may elect people that not all of us like. That's part of democracy. So I think that's also something we need to accept, and that's ultimately a strength. On the other hand, we also need to be aware that we should not make it easier for our adversaries to drive us apart. A lot of disinformation, uses wedge issues. You know, migration, of course, is one that works both in the United States and in Europe. Corruption may be another one, all the culture wars. So to be aware of how those things can be turned against our democracies, and to take apart those mechanisms and to expose them. I think the role, you do follow the money. I think the role of the media is also absolutely key, because by being transparent and making our democracies work better, we also defend ourselves against those sorts of tendencies, and the ability of countries like Russia, China, but also Iran, North Korea, and others to exploit those differences against ourselves. It's about ourselves to make ourselves stronger in the end. We tend to always look outside, but as you say, it's about our own inner strength, both as individuals, as citizens, but also as societies.
Is the answer to your question? Okay. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. My name's Ian Kenny. I work at the John Adams Institute in Amsterdam. Please excuse any baked-in cynicism my question might imply, but I was wondering, to your mind, has it taken a tangible threat in the form of a belligerent nation state like Russia to reinvigorate or unify NATO, or at least awaken the public's interest in the alliance again? As in, do you see this as a potential opportunity, not only as a threat? Some of the other things you've mentioned, like terrorism and climate change, are often moving targets and a little bit more difficult to inspire public kind of unity for.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And certainly, Anna was there at NATO, Eric Povel, I see. Sometimes it's much harder to communicate, and I certainly felt that, when people don't understand, what is the threat? Why are you doing this? What is this for? Surely, NATO can disband and everything will be fine. Not to be cynical about it, it's a fact. I think it helped when the new strategic concept actually acknowledged that, yes, Russia is the most direct threat and that China poses a challenge, that there are other challenges, together with terrorism and hybrid threats. Because before, when we say, Russia is not an adversary, we don't define Russia as an adversary, it was politically helpful. We kept the high moral ground, but it was harder to mobilize public opinion, because they didn't quite understand, why are you doing all these things? Why do you have to spend 2% of GDP on defense? What is this against? And of course, as a communicator, I would much prefer to talk about, you know, what we're for, you know, and the values and the democracy, the way of life that that we protect. But it's true that fear is perhaps a more powerful feeling than hope. I say that, you know, not with cynicism, but with realism. So sometimes it takes fear to galvanize action.
I was wondering how you look at this, because there was, of course, a Munich Security Conference. They always have opinion polls. And there you actually saw, like, the threats perceived by the public are not the same as the threats perceived by NATO or the NATO spokesperson or by General Rombauer even. The main threats that are identified as terrorism and migration amongst member states. Another thing that was discussed also at the Munich Security Conference was the difference between different member states also within NATO about their threat perception towards Russia, for example, even. So I was wondering, we'll just park the member state because we already, you know, went through this, but how do you see it when it comes to the public? If their threat perception, because of course Rombauer can say, you know, on a talk show that we should, you know, use cans of bean and everything and have a flashlight and be prepared for the worst. But if the public doesn't perceive it that way, if the public doesn't perceive it as an imminent threat, how do you bridge this divide, so to say, between the public and the elites?
Well, in terms of NATO, we have our own polling, and again, it's online. I say we, NATO. Some of the biggest challenges in our polling, I think, is the cost of living crisis. Mm-hmm. So I think there are many. It also depends on how you ask the question, to be honest.
Where you can choose from.
We also need to be aware of that. But I think if you look, for instance, at the younger generation, certainly 2 years or so ago, climate change remains, you know, the biggest long-term threat. And I think the Munich Security Conference polling also showed climate change as the longest-term threat, but disinformation as the short-term threat. So, again, it will be very different. But that was also one of the reasons why I think it was really important for NATO, with the strategic concept, but also in the decisions that it took, to be much more focused on climate change as something, you know, that will affect everything that we do and does affect everything that we do. So there are different types of threats and challenges out there. And some will resonate more with certain audiences and certain people. But I think as an alliance, we need to take the overview and to take all of them into account. And ultimately, you know, when you sign up to a strategic concept, when you sign up to a threat perception, military threat perception document and analysis, there is buy-in from all allies, because those are documents that all allies have agreed on. So it may appear sometimes that they have different threat perceptions, but I think in terms of NATO, there is a very clear view.
They signed the document, so to say.
They signed the document, so it must be. They must all agree. Yes.
Yes. Any other questions from the audience? Yes.
My name is Trix van Mierlo. I'm with the Independent Policy and Operation Evaluation Department of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I have a question on NATO-EU cooperation. You've given some good examples where there's a sign of unity. And I wanted to ask where you actually saw actual cooperation between the two organizations. And I would like to learn which factors have helped in that cooperation.
I think one of the greatest example for cooperation is Kosovo. Because we still have over 5,000 troops there, reinforced with reinforcements in the last year, but of course it's the EU High Representative who is trying to reach a political agreement for normalization of relations. And for instance, when Belgrade and Pristina agreed on the license plate arrangement to facilitate Serbian and Kosovo cars to cross from one part of the border to the other. That was an agreement that was negotiated by the EU in Brussels, but it was implemented with the support of NATO troops on the ground in Kosovo. So I think that was, and that was based on great cooperation on the ground, but also great cooperation in Brussels between the two organizations. So I think that's a good example of how things can work.
Thank you. My name is Michiel Heijmans. I work for the Klingendaal Institute as an associate fellow. You mentioned consensus in NATO, and that's a very strong thing, because if we have 32 members, consensus, it's very good. But on the other hand, I think it might also be a threat. We see now, especially with the Swedes and the Finns, and now what is happening in the election of Rutte, we also see that it can be a big challenge, because some countries are trying to, well, almost take NATO as a hostage to get out a lot for themselves. Do you think, of course, if you want to change that, you need consensus, and it will never change. But do you see this also as a threat, or do you think we can overcome it?
Yeah, I'm aware of all the discussions in the EU about, introducing qualified majority voting in lots of areas where you have unanimity right now. I'll be honest, I sometimes wish that there was that in NATO. I don't think it's going to happen. I think there's a very clear understanding that NATO will continue to function on the basis of consensus, even with 32 allies. Often messy, absolutely. Sometimes time-consuming. You know, you need to be to be a very patient man or person to be Secretary General, as I think Mr. De Hoopscheffer knows very well. I think it helps to have run a coalition government in your home country, you know, if for the Secretary General to negotiate those sort of agreements. But ultimately, that's what makes NATO strong. And, you know, NATO is not just about money. NATO is about life and death. So when you ask nations to put their troops in harm's way, you know, you can understand that the price for that is consensus. Yeah, I think there will always be a tendency, and it happens with lots of allies, as it happens with lots of member states in the EU, to try to internationalize what are ultimately bilateral issues or national interests, perhaps in the other organization, right? It may not just be with NATO, it may be with the EU. So, you know, let's try to do some deals in NATO so that we can get something unblocked in the EU. And that's totally unfortunate. I agree with you. But ultimately, the enlargement with Finland to Finland and Sweden happened. And that was a geostrategic and is a geostrategic game changer. Nobody would have thought that. You know, frankly, I think I don't know how many people in this room 3 years ago would have thought, beginning of 21, would you have thought that possible? I wouldn't have done so, frankly. And it was only, as you remember, it was Putin's draft treaties to NATO and the EU basically imposing a halt to enlargement, to NATO enlargement, not just to Ukraine and Georgia, but also to Finland and Sweden, which actually triggered that move towards NATO accession. And the fact that both countries are there now, yeah, it's taken a bit of time. It's still the shortest accession process in the history of NATO. That's okay. Okay. Eric, go ahead.
We've been colleagues a long time at NATO, at public diplomacy. One final question, maybe also nice to end, that everybody in the Netherlands is talking about, is Mark Rutte's chances to become the next Secretary General. So you've been very close to Stoltenberg, and you traveled with him also to the White House, also to Donald Trump. So do you have any advice for Mr. Rutte how he should handle a potential Trump presidency?
Okay, that makes a couple of assumptions there, yeah. I think that Mark Rutte would be a very good Secretary General. There are two candidates in this race right now, so we'll have to see how that works. As far as I know, Prime Minister Rutte has, I think the support of probably 29 out of 32 for now. So we'll have to see how that plays out. Of course, the risk when you have two candidates is that a third one may emerge. My personal, and that's something I said back in November last year, and that's a very personal hope that I have, is that there is a decision fast. There's a fast decision on somebody, a strong leader who can unite the alliance. Because I think it would be unfortunate if this process is delayed and if it gets tangled up in the European elections and the outcome of the EU elections in terms of the distribution of portfolios in the big EU institutions. That can delay things even more. And also if it is made too late in the election cycle in the US, because we see how often things can become toxic in election campaigns in many places, but also in the US. So that's my hope. Otherwise, it's in the hands of allied heads of state and government, as you know. It's not. I have no vote in this, and neither does Jens Stoltenberg, actually.
Would you vote for Mark Rutte if you had a vote in it?
If I was the head of state and government. Look, I think he has great qualities. You know, he's a cool head, steady hand, the second most experienced leader in Europe, longest running after Viktor Orban, of course. And somebody who I think also has, coming to Eric's question, also has a good working relationship both with Joe Biden and with Donald Trump, and has also shown that he can also push back when needed. We'll have to see. I think, I will be very honest, I think it would really help to make clear that the Netherlands is indeed investing 2% of GDP on defense, and to do that sooner rather than later. Again, that's a very personal view.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
That was former NATO spokesperson and advisor to the Secretary General, Oana Lungescu, in conversation with journalist Duurtje Kuipers. The talk took place at our new location, Het Nutshuis. You're sure to hear more events coming from our new location in future podcasts. The Netherlands Atlantic Association has many fascinating and exciting events just like this one all year round. Just go to atlcom.nl to find out more and sign up for the newsletter. That's atlcom.nl. And while you're at it, why not look for the association on social media? You can find us on LinkedIn, Instagram, X, formerly called Twitter, and Facebook. That's it for this edition of De Atlantische Blik from the Netherlands Atlantic Association. I'm Jonathan Gruber. Thank you for listening.